Barbarian tribes of Rome. Germanic women. The status of women in the Germanic society. Now, the position of women as individuals in the Germanic society of the Iron Age, in many respects, this is not clear. Even as regards the position of women in the community, there are many complicating factors. It is true that the woman had no political rights, that is, she could not claim the right to participate in the popular or tribal assemblies, which were called together from time to time, to decide upon matters of importance to the community as a whole, such matters as war and peace, for instance. In this respect, the woman was represented by her father, brother, or husband, as the case might be, and the only influence she had was exerted behind the scenes. Yet we are told by some Roman writers that the Germanic people had a very great reverence for women, considering there was such an aura of mysticism about them, which made them especially suitable for prognostication, the future, and serving in the capacity of priestesses, as among the Cimbri and the Teutons, and apparently also in the camp of Ariovistus, who refrained from a general attack because the soothsaying and lot-casting women had declared that the time was unpropitious. There were Germanic goddesses of fertility cult origin also who were highly revered, such as Nethrus of the Ingvenoni and Freya. According to the Eddic poems, it would appear that at least the supernatural element claimed and took quite a number of liberties. It is misleading to draw conclusions as to the attitude towards women in Germanic times from the instances which have been recorded when they acted as priestesses. One suspects that the latter such women would have been called witches. Women's rights as individuals within the home are in somewhat of a different category. They are partly legal and partly traditional. There is no doubt that legally the woman at marriage came under the guardianship of the man, and before marriage and when unmarried under the guardianship of her father or other senior male member of the family. This legal authority of the man over the wife was a survival of the practice of wife purchase, according to which the man theoretically could dispose of that which he had purchased in any way he saw fit. It was not, however, quite so simple as that. If he were proven guilty of any act of violence against a woman, he had to reckon with the wife's relatives, and a deadly feud could easily arise. If we may judge from the Icelandic sagas, perhaps experience had taught the Icelandic husbands that it was better to leave the woman alone to do as they wished, even if they acted in a belligerent manner. Poor Gunnar of Njal's saga discovered this when he made the mistake of slapping his wife in anger at the trouble she had caused. Years later, in a moment of dire need, this cost him his life. But conditions in the Icelandic sagas probably cannot be taken at their full value for a much earlier time. Theoretically, it was possible for a man to give away or sell both wife and children, but it's very doubtful whether this right was often exercised. Theoretically, also the parents had the right to arrange the marriage of their daughter, and no doubt this was the practice. But the wishes of the daughter were often taken into consideration. There are plenty of instances of this in the Icelandic sagas, and the poet of the Beowulf comments doubtfully on the wisdom of giving the daughter in marriage to an enemy with the hope that this would be a way to peace. Yet the synonym for women in the poem is weaver of peace. Insofar as the Nibelungen reflects earlier times, it is quite clear that some women at least exercised a very great personal influence. We have seen the same phenomena in Frankish Merovingian history. In the Beowulf, Hrothgar's queen is granted social equality, and she further takes it upon herself to express opinions on matters of tribal and political importance. The following passage from the Beowulf illustrates this attitude. Came Withelwell forth, queen of Holgar, heedful of courtesy, gold-decked, greeted the guests in the hall, and the high-born lady handed the cup first to the East Dane's heir and warden, and bade him to blithe in the beer carouse, the land's beloved one. Through the hall they went, with the Hemmings lady, to older and younger everywhere carried a cup, till came the moment when the ring-graced queen, the royal-hearted to Beowulf, bore the beaker of the mead. From what evidence is available, and here it is necessary to lean rather heavily on the Icelandic sagas, it would appear that the married women had the keys of the house, and was allowed almost complete control of everything connected with household management. It is reasonably certain that this represented the practice of earlier times also, a practice which usually prevails in any well-established and flourishing agricultural community. It is doubtful that the practice of sati, the immolation of the woman willingly or unwillingly on the bier of the dead husband, was anything but a poetic motif, except in a very few and exceptional cases of renowned leaders of the people. The motif occurs in literature. We find it in the Niflund matter, and we also find it in the poetic Edda. No doubt many a Germanic warrior dreamed of such devotion, and the poets encouraged him. But it is not likely that many of the women followed the poetic examples. The self-destruction of the woman after a lost battle and the death of the male members of their family is an entirely different category. This self-destruction was to avoid the horrors of slavery, a fate always worse for women than men. In the Icelandic sagas, the purchase price paid for the bride often had to be returned to the parents of the woman in case of a separation. Property which the woman legally owned, she could take with her on separation from her husband. In the remnants of ancient Germanic literature, there are many sarcastic references to the mischief caused by women, and there are also many eulogies. A great deal depends on the poet's experience. On the one hand, we have the spitefulness of Gunnar's wife and her refusal to render assistance in a moment of peril. And on the other, we have the fidelity of Bergthora, wife of Njal, who would not be parted from him or the home in which they lived. On the one hand, we have the revenge of Brunhilde on Siegfried for what she believed was his infidelity. And on the other hand, we have the self-immolation to follow him to Valhalla. It is impossible to generalize. Human nature has at all times been much the same. It used to be claimed that the change in motivation of the later form of the Nibelung, whereby Kirnhild avenges the death of her husband at the hands of her brothers, as compared with the earlier version where she avenges the death of her brothers at the hands of the horde-seeking Attila, was caused by the higher conception in the 12th century of the obligations of the marriage vow. This was an unjustified generalization made on the assumption that the marriage state under Christian belief was more binding and sacred than among the pagans. There is no foundation for such an assumption. The regard for marriage state among the Germanic pagans is, so far as there is evidence, was just as high as after the acceptance of Christianity. Now, next time, we'll be looking at feuds and punishments. Now, the source for this: The Germanic People, Their Origin, Expansion, and Culture by Owens, Civilization of the Celts by Launay, Civilization of the Steppes by Conrad. So I hope you enjoyed that. And as always, don't forget to come by the website, sumahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.